Claire in discussion. I'm a scientist. There's a lot of you here from totally different disciplines. So I don't think I'm going to tax you in any way with this this particular topic. But winged creatures. So here's two. This is a really interesting book, a picture of a book. I like taking pictures of photographs of documents and books for some reason. And this is a book called The Myology of the Raven. It's often misquoted as being the mythology of the raven, because the raven, of course, has a fascinating mythology. This is myology, which is the study of the muscles. It was published in 1824 by a German author, and it's in Glasgow University Library, and it is beautiful. I was taking pictures of it, and this weevil sort of thudded onto the page while I was there with my camera, and that was the result. It's not photoshopped, I promise. So there we go, there's two. So, winged creatures. One thing that's really significant for biologists like myself is that flight, despite being just spectacularly useful for any animal, actually only evolved, as far as we know, four times in the 3.5 or 4,000 million year history of life, during which time mountains were raised and eroded back down and formed sedimentary rocks and all the rest of it. Four times, okay? So we have insects, okay? They got powered flight with wings once. Birds, of course. Bats, so mammals can fly. And pterosaurs, which of course are extinct reptiles. Just in case we get too fixated on birds, this is a taxonomic breakdown of metazoan and multi-celled organisms. So excuse me, bacteria and viruses, you don't make it onto this. But this is an example. So here we have birds. I'm just looking at this now. I've got this a bit wrong, because the birds should be slightly thicker than mammals. So there's more birds than our mammals. But that's kind of birds and mammals, a little tiny bit here. I think this is reptiles here. Yeah, the reptiles and amphibians together, tiny portions of global diversity. But this is, of course, the insects, the majority of which have wings, the majority of which can fly. So although it's kind of quite rare, it has taxonomically been very significant, largely thanks to our friends, the insects, upon which, of course, we all depend. So, a wee while back, I was invited to talk at an event. It was the Year of Scotland's Homecoming, this SNP organised. And it was the then Environment Minister, Mike Russell, organised this event. And the whole thing was sold on the idea that we're going to do something that's new, something that's cutting edge with this event. We're going to marry the world of the arts with the world of nature and natural history. And this is cutting edge and it's new. Well, this is a Pictish symbol stone from the Orkney Islands, which, if any of you are from around here, that's the islands off to the very north of Scotland, an archipelago of lovely islands where I used to live and work. And it's 1,000 years old, okay, and it depicts a sea eagle. There's really no doubt that it's a sea eagle. There are only two eagles that are native to this country, the golden eagle and the sea eagle. And anyone who knows the bird or goes bird watching will know, and has seen sea eagles, that this kind of stance and this kind of raggedy back end is very characteristic of sea eagles. But what really nails it is this, the tarsi here. Now the tarsi, these little bits of the legs on a golden eagle are feathered right down to the feet, and on the sea eagle they aren't. So this is a sea eagle, and beautiful it is too. Probably it is associated with a kind of early Christian society in Scotland, but exactly how is not quite sure. Does this represent St. John, as I was saying earlier? Don't really know. I've read some books about what these symbol stones actually mean, and we haven't a clue really. So that was unearthed on the mainland of Orkney. Just around the corner, down the road, another orc of the Orkney Islands called South Ronaldsay is this. This is a Neolithic chambered cairn at a site called Isbister. And Orkney is utterly riddled with archaeological sites. And this one was the farmer actually wanted it excavated, and they wouldn't do it. They couldn't get around to it. Historic Scotland were busy doing other things. Never got around to it, so he just did it himself. Not to be recommended, but he actually made a spectacularly good job of it. It's widely recognised by professional archaeologists as being a really good job that was done by him and his family in their spare time. And inside they found the remains, this is a burial site, and the remains of 300 odd people, okay? And alongside them, on the floor, were this arranged quite carefully with the skulls of 14 sea eagles. And this is now commonly known, known as the Tomb of the Eagles, and it's a site people can go and visit. So there we go. What do we know about these people? Well, I actually worked on another island in Orkney called Papawestry. I worked on the home of Papawestry, which is a little uninhabited island, and it has an excavated chamber of cairn as well. And I used to sleep in the chamber of cairn, so it was the driest place. And I used to lie there, you know, in my sleeping bag, you know, and look at the kind of markings on the wall, cup and ring markings that were there. And, you know, and I did some reading around it, and we know little about the Pictish symbol stones. We know virtually nothing really for sure about what was going on for these people. And so, is it all impossibly remote? Well, some archaeologists from the University of Sussex did a reconstruction on one of the skulls from the Isbister chambered cairn. And that's what this girl looked like. And she wouldn't look out of place walking down Byers Road on a Saturday. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that when this was being carved, she had already been dead for 3,000 years. Okay, so here we have a species that has a tradition of cultural significance for Scottish people which spanned millennia before the terms ecology, natural history, conservation were even dreamed of. So I'm glad to say that the species was driven to extinction by Victorian persecution. The last one was killed in 1915, I believe, in Shetland. But now the RSPB has been instrumental in reintroducing the species. Is it rewilding? Who knows? But it's now established quite well. It's about 36 pairs. And it's doing very well. Well, how do I know it's doing very well? Well, I know because people like Diana's son, who is one of the RSPB's really top research scientists, do things like monitoring these birds, monitor their breeding performance, and monitor the survival of the adults from 1 year to the next, and other demographic parameters. And from that, we figure out how they're doing in relation to other areas of the world and in relation to what's actually possible. And these birds are increasing slowly. This is about 35, 40 pairs. But it's as fast as anyone could possibly hope for this species. So they're doing quite well. And we know that because of science. So there's kind of this ancient link between people and nature in Scotland. Was that it? Well, no. When at the end of the 18th century, Robert Burns apologised to a mouse in the 18th century that man's dominion had broken nature's social union, I think it could be argued that he crystallised and preempted 2 centuries of environmental philosophy, really, in 8 words. So, not bad. So the artistic tradition around nature and the link from that through to environmental thinking, environmental sensibility, is quite strong. So where does science sit in this? Well, I got this book recently. It's Pliny the Elder's Natural History. It's a tiny, abridged version of it. And I kind of got it because I thought, well, if I can sort of glean some ancient wisdom, I can kind of show off and appear terribly clever. And Pliny said this and Pliny said that. And it is really fascinating read, actually. But the most fascinating thing about this is that it is wall-to-wall bunkum. So he talks about how swallows pluck their own feathers out and hide in sunny corners of the mountains through the winter. He talks about how the goby, which is a fish that big, actually stops ships in their tracks and hauls them backwards. He talks about how ravens live for 3,500 years. It is absolutely riddled with inaccuracy and invention. And Chinese whispers, the thing is, he constantly refers back to people who lived hundreds of years before him and what they said. There's the veneration of the ancients. And my notion, I'm not prepared to have it knocked down because I don't really know much about these things, but I mean, my notion, my understanding of history, is that that's that view, which was that really we have to look back to ancient knowledge to actually know what was really going on, actually dominated the fields of natural history right up until the time of people like Thomas Pyrrhic, the end of the 18th century, when we really started to get the notion that you didn't have to just regurgitate what had been said before, that there could be genuine, original observation, that you could write what you thought, okay? What you thought and what you saw. Now, I think Aristotle understood the importance of observation, but I kind of think that nobody really had the nerve to actually do it until we get to that critical point, the end of the 18th century. Right, does anyone know who that is? Test. That's interesting. This is a guy called Alexander Wilson, and he was from Paisley. Paisley, for those of you who are visitors to Glasgow, Paisley is a town that's kind of contiguous with Glasgow in terms of being part of the Clydeside conurbation. It's all urban between here and Paisley. It's just down the road, but it's kind of culturally rather fiercely independent, I would say. It's very interesting. It's got a fantastic astronomical observatory put up by some philanthropist in the early 20th century, and is still there. It's great to visit in the winter, by the way. So he was from Paisley, son of a weaver, and a poet and artist, and a radical. Paisley was a hotbed of radical thought, and was big centre of the cuts of, you know, late 18th century and early Victorian weaving industry, and the weavers were treated badly by their bosses, and they started an industrial struggle on the back of that. Wilson, the young Wilson, wrote a poem called The Shark about the owner of one of the mills, powerful owner of one of the mills, and ended up in prison because of it. It's a complex story. He got out eventually, and he left Paisley. He left. He wrote a poem called Loch Winnock, which is now an RSPB reserve, where he writes about seeing bitterns, hearing bitterns in Loch Winnock. They don't occur there anymore. They haven't occurred there for years and years and years and years. But he was a naturalist, he was a poet, he was an artist, he was a correspondent of Burns, of Robert Burns. In 1794, he slung his hook from, it's too dangerous to stay in Paisley. He went to America. And there he became the father of American ornithology. The Wilson's warbler, Wilson's snipe, Wilson's phalarope, Wilson's petrel, there's a genus of passerines called Wilsonia, all down to this guy. His 10-volume American Ornithology is the beginning of ornithology in America, and is hugely significant because it also signifies something of beginning of what we would call, your son would call ornithology. Which is where he, in this new world, where he very quickly embraced being an American and an American identity, the new world notion that every man had the right to go out and make observations and write them down in his own right, was very much in the forefront of his mind, and he went out and did it. And in fact, he was the model behind the character of Hawkeye in The Last of the Mohicans. So, James Fenimore Cooper was interviewed about this, and he said, who did you base Hawkeye on? And he said, it's a Scotchman called Wilson. So Wilson had put his buckskins on, took his gun, of course, because all naturalists shot what they were studying in those days. They didn't just shoot them. And he set off from Philadelphia and he walked to Niagara. And he walked all the way back again. And he walked thousands and thousands of miles, recording meticulously the birds that he saw and painting them. And this is an example of one of his paintings. And I'm just going to touch on this. But there's a much more famous. Who's heard of John James Audubon? Mm. Everyone's heard of Audubon, haven't they? Well, this is Wilson's bald eagle. And that's Audubon's bald eagle, made some years later. The two did meet. Didn't get on, apparently. But there's, well, I'll let you decide for yourselves. There's some pretty heavy indications of some plagiarism going on here. So Wilson wrote beautifully. And he wrote descriptively, and he wrote what he saw. So I'm just going to read out a passage from American Ornithology about one species. So, happening to go ashore one charming afternoon to purchase some milk at a house that stood near the river, and while talking with the people within doors, I was suddenly struck with astonishment at a loud rushing roar succeeded by instant darkness, which, on the first moment, I took for a tornado about to overwhelm the house and everything around in destruction. The people, observing my surprise, coolly said, "It's only the pigeons." And on running out, I beheld a flock 30 or 40 yards in width, sweeping along very low between the house and the mountain that formed the second bank of the river. They continued passing for more than a quarter of an hour, and at length varied their bearings so as to pass over the mountain behind which they disappeared. Okay, so at the beginnings of real observation, we have the origins of, if you like, of proper taxonomy, which Buick was engaged with. These two came together to sort of form a sort of natural science, which then started to inform conservation thinking. In the middle of the 18th century, a guy called Alfred Newton, Cambridge University, noticed that over-collecting of this bird, the great auk, flightless, great auk, but of course flightless. They fly underwater. Wing swimming underwater, by the way, is the most energetically efficient form of locomotion for any warm-blooded animal ever recorded. Okay, so wings don't just fly in air, they fly in water as well. Seabird, about that high. Newton realized that great auks seemed to be disappearing, and he said, as time that we decided not to just collect these things, we need to leave an inheritance to future generations that means more than that. And he went off to Iceland to try and find great auks, and he wanted to instigate a captive breeding program, which is fairly advanced for his time, kind of thing that still goes on today. Unfortunately, he was too late. The last great auk was killed in 1844 on an island called Ide off the southeast corner of Iceland by fishermen for Victorian collectors. Having said that, though, no species of bird that occurs anywhere in Europe has ever gone extinct since the formation of the RSPB by a group of women in Manchester who were campaigning against the then enormous trade in feathers for millinery and fashion. And those ladies put together a really effective campaign that went on quite quickly to start to encompass all bird conservation in the round. This notion was, of course, simultaneously, this was 1889, this notion was simultaneously informed, of course, by the work of Alfred Russel Wallace and Charles Darwin, who took the idea of form and function that people like Buick and Wilson in particular had been recognizing and then had grown into an academic discipline characterized by Newton in Cambridge, and taken that to, if you like, its logical conclusion beyond the theological, which was a theory of evolution. And from this, we understood that diversity has a function, the notion that what can be there tomorrow can only derive from what we have today, the idea that conserving that diversity is a valuable thing to do. And this came to fruition at the beginning of the 20th century. At about the same time as when this, I mean, I put this in just because to my mind, this is the most beautiful and most tragic photograph in the whole of ornithology, because this is the species that Wilson was writing about. Those pigeons that darkened the sky, the thunderous roar that was coming. This is a passenger pigeon, and this is the very last one. This is Martha, passenger pigeon, the last one, 1914, this photograph was taken, Cincinnati Zoo, on the 1st of September of that year, she was found dead of old age in the bottom of her cage. The very last passenger pigeon, by, in all probability, the most common bird species that has ever existed on the face of the earth, was totally wiped out by concerted effort at killing, but by people. If you think that, you know, there isn't some sort of biodiversity crisis going on, just remember about the passenger pigeon. And one thing I found out recently, so have I got this in? Oh yes, just so you know that Audubon, he was a bit of a white boy, but he really could paint. And this is his painting of the Carolina parakeet. This is also a species that is now extinct. And what I found out recently is the last Carolina parakeet died in the same cage in Cincinnati Zoo as the last passenger pigeon. Okay, so this notion of, you know, the natural world is important. Often people think, well, it's kind of a middle class luxury, isn't it? It's sort of, you know, well, it's all very well, but there's more important issues. The Second World War illustrates that's not necessarily the case, because the conservation legislation in this country, the real meat of it, was originated in 1941, spring 1941, under orders of Churchill, under the Department of Post-War Reconstruction, and the notion that the environment of this country is actually the essence of what we're about and what we're fighting was very much in the public campaign. This poster from 1940. Okay, so my job is to convince people that this sort of thing is important. We have had a 70% reduction in biomass of zooplankton in the northeast Atlantic. This is food for a sand eel, and a sand eel is food for a bird. We find it's often the case that the complex environmental issues, in order to capture the public attention, and therefore to capture the attention of politicians, requires something that people can actually latch onto and has spiritual and aesthetic resonance with them. And really, I haven't really answered the question, why should it be birds? I don't know. But it certainly does seem to be birds. The RSPB has a million members. And if you would like to join up too, I've got forms in my bag. Thank you very much.